From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air, wishing you a Merry Christmas.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
That's a track from the box set Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. On today's Fresh Air, we celebrate Christmas with some great music. First, we'll hear from the producers of the Sinatra box set. Then singer Michael Feinstein will share some rare recordings from his private collection. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hi, folks. This is Frank Sinatra speaking to you from a projection room at Universal International Studio out here in Hollywood. We've just screened my new picture, Meet Danny Wilson, and the gang out here have been kidding me that this is the story of my own life. Actually, I wish my life was as exciting as Danny Wilson's. However, there is one real life parallel in the picture. It's in the music. I'd like to sing you one of the songs to give you an idea of what I mean.
You're a sweetheart, if there ever was one.
That promotional spot and song from the 1952 movie Meet Danny Wilson are included in a 6-CD box set called Frank Sinatra in Hollywood, 1940 to 1964. It collects the songs from such films as On the Town, Young at Heart, Guys and Dolls, The Tender Trap, and Robin in the Seven Hoods, as well as more obscure films. Only 10% of the 160 tracks have ever been previously issued in any audio format. In the movies, many of these songs were in scenes where dialogue or sound effects obscured the music. The box set has the complete performances that were recorded before the other sounds were added. We're going to listen to and talk about some of the music with the producers of the box set, Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch. Granata is the author of the book Sessions with Sinatra, Frank Sinatra and the Art of Recording. Deutsch is a veteran record producer. Our interview was recorded in July when the box set was released. This interview kicks off our holiday week series Encores, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Charles Granata, Didier Deutsch, welcome to Fresh Air. Why don't we listen to a couple of the recordings on here and compare them? And this is from the film The Tender Trap. I don't think this is a great film. And I never really used to think this was a great record until I saw the film and watched Sinatra sing the song. And it just, the rhythm of it is so contagious. So I've actually come to like the song. I thought we could hear two versions. The first version is the title sequence version, the version that's sung over the titles. Is this the same version that was the hit version that was released on Capitol Records?
No, this is the film version. The version that you heard on the Capitol recording was a re-recording that was done in the studio for Capitol at the time the film was released. So this is really the screen version.
And it does differ because for the commercial Capitol recording, Frank Sinatra used a Nelson Riddle arrangement. And you hear a big difference in instrumentation and orchestration. And there's a different energy to the Capitol recording when you compare it to the film recording. And there's a different jauntiness that I feel comes across in the film recording. It's just a little more spontaneous.
And I thought we can compare that back-to-back with just a piano vocal version that he does in the body of the film. And this is, if I'm remembering the film correctly, Debbie Reynolds is singing this song. I think maybe she's rehearsing it for an audition, and he's saying, no, you got it wrong. Try it this way. And he shows her how it should be done.
Right.
That's right, yes.
And of course, this piano vocal version places the performance and the song in a completely different context. Because rather than having this big band with this energetic Nelson Riddle chart, we have just Frank Sinatra and Bill Miller on piano, which gives it a whole different feel.
So here they are back to back, the title sequence of Tender Trap and a duet from the body of the film.
You see a pair of laughing eyes, and suddenly you're sighing sighs. You're thinking nothing's wrong, you string along, boy, then snap. Those eyes, those sighs, they're part of the tender trap. You're hand in hand beneath the tree, and soon there's music in the breeze. You're acting kind of smart until your heart just goes whap. Those trees, that breeze, they're part of the tender trap. Some starry night, when her kisses make you tingle, she'll hold you tight, and you'll hate yourself for being single. And all at once it seems so nice. The folks are throwing shoes and rice. see a pair of laughing eyes, and suddenly you're sighing sighs. You're thinking nothing's wrong, you string along, boy, then snap. Those eyes, those sighs, they're part of the tender trap. You see what I mean? You just gotta let it settle a little bit. You're hand in hand beneath the trees, and soon there's music in the breeze. You're acting kinda smart until your heart just goes whap. Those trees, that breeze, they're part of the tender trap. Some starry night, when her kisses make you tingle, she'll hold you tight, and you'll hate yourself for being single. And all at once it seems so nice, the folks are throwing shoes and rice. You hurry to a spot that's just a dot on the map. You wonder how it all came about. It's too late now, there's no getting out. You fell in love. Some starry night, when her kisses make you tingle, she'll hold you tight, and you'll hate yourself for being single. And all at once it seems so nice, the folks are throwing shoes and rice. You hurry to a spot that's just a dot on the map. Boom, 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 boom. You wonder how it all came about. It's too late now, there's no getting out. You fell in love, and love is a tent.
That's two versions of The Tender Trap from the film of the same name on the new box set, Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. My guests are the box set's co-producers, Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch. Now, one of the things Sinatra had to do, which I guess all performers had to do in the movies at the time, was to lip sync to their songs. How did it work? The songs were pre-recorded and then you lip sync to it on film?
Well, usually, yes. They went into the studio, laid down the tracks, performed the song. Then, when they started shooting, the song was played on a playback equipment so that they could lip-sync and emote at the same time. So there was no huffing and puffing as they were acting. They were simply lip-syncing. And that's why it comes so naturally on the screen.
Now, Charles Granata, you say in your liner notes that Sinatra hated lip-syncing in the movies. Why did he hate it so much?
You know, Frank Sinatra had a very interesting way of approaching his commercial recording sessions. He would prepare endlessly, and when he went into the studio, he would spend an inordinate amount of time working to accomplish what he felt was the perfect recording. On the film soundstage, as an actor, he had a completely different philosophy. He would want to do one or two takes because he felt doing more than that robbed his performance of its freshness. And I think the lip-syncing aspect of making films in Hollywood was a big part of that for Frank Sinatra. He felt that if he couldn't stand before the camera and perform and sing live, as it were, in this case live to film, it didn't have the vitality that he was looking for, that he felt was necessary to emote as an actor.
Well, in his performances, normally, was there a rehearsed spontaneity in which, in the films, he was robbed? He could not have that rehearsed spontaneity?
Well, when you listen to Frank Sinatra's commercial recording sessions in toto, in other words, if you listen to him breaking down and doing take after take after take, he's obviously building the vocal style for that particular song. And you're right. In many instances, he alters things from take to take. And when he had to lip sync, he felt that he was not free to let loose and bend the lyric according to how he was feeling at that very moment.
My guests are Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch, co-producers of the box set Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch, producers of the box set Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. Well, a Sinatra film I particularly love is represented on here. It's called Young at Heart, and Sinatra plays a piano player, like a barroom piano player, who thinks that he's cursed with lifelong bad luck, so he's constantly depressed. And he kind of wanders into the life of Doris Day, who's this real kind of sunshiny character, and kind of tries so hard to help him out of this slump, and it's a wonderful film. They even get to sing a duet together at the end. You have a few songs from this film represented in the box set. One of them is Someone to Watch Over Me. What's the story behind the version you've used on this box set, Charles?
With Someone to Watch Over Me, when we arrived in the studio in Los Angeles, we knew that we were going to find the vocal and piano performance, which is what is heard in the film. What we were surprised to find as we ran through the various session tapes is this bit of orchestral sweetening. And at first we were a little perplexed because it wasn't heard that way in the film. We didn't know that it existed. And we spent a couple hours matching it up. And our biggest accomplishment on that particular day was being able to create a brand new mix with Frank Sinatra and the orchestra married to this piano version of Someone to Watch Over Me, which I think is the most incredible Gershwin tune, you know, in their whole catalog.
And the sweetening does something that did not exist in the movie, which is very interesting. The orchestral sweetening was not entirely... they didn't use it, I think, because it was not entirely successful. There was a bridge in which the orchestra was fighting with the vocal. So what we did, when that came in, we dropped the orchestra, so there is simply the vocal singing the bridge, and then we brought up the orchestra again for the refrain, and it works beautifully. I think that it's one of the songs in that box set that I like very much as a result of the work we did on it.
It really brings a tenderness to the performance.
Yes.
So here's Frank Sinatra, Bill Miller at the piano, from the movie Young at Heart, as featured on the new box set, Frank Sinatra in Hollywood.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that she turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. I'm a little lamb who's lost in the wood. I know I could always Although
not be the man some girls think of as handsome, but to her heart I'll carry the key. Won't you tell her, please, to put on some speed, follow my lead. Someone to watch over me.
That's Someone to Watch Over Me, remixed for the new box set Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. It's from the film Young at Heart. My guests are Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch, the co-producers of this new box set. Now, you talk in the liner notes about the differences between Sinatra's approach to filmmaking and to making studio recordings. You actually have a rehearsal session featured on this box tape from Robin in the Seven Hoods. And it's Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr., doing the rehearsal for a song called Don't Be a Do-Badder. Actually, I think they're trying to do the final take. They're not trying to rehearse it, but it keeps not happening for them. Charles, tell us a little bit about this session and why you wanted to include it on the box.
Well, this is one of those golden moments that you unearth as you do work that Didier and I are doing. And you're scouring the vaults and searching for unusual and rare material. And the first day we were in Los Angeles and working at the Film Transfer Studio, we got a call from the Warner Brothers archivist who said he had found these unmixed session tapes from Robin and the Seven Hoods. And as you listen to the session tape, you need to remember that this is the Rat Pack. These are these three famous guys who are at the top of their game, at the top of their world in 1963, unedited and uncensored. They weren't mugging for a camera. They weren't standing and going through a rehearsed routine for an audience. This was how these guys really were as friends. And I think that real spirit of camaraderie and real love and genuine affection for each other just comes through so beautifully here. And obviously, you know, this is a great chance to study how Frank Sinatra and these guys worked in the studio.
Well, the other thing that comes through is that Frank Sinatra wants to get out. He wants to stop doing takes, wants to finish it, and leave.
Absolutely, as was his wont many times. You know, as I mentioned earlier, and I mentioned in my liner notes, Frank Sinatra really was a very restless individual. And, you know, it didn't matter whether it was in the recording studio, in front of a television camera, speaking to an interviewer on the film soundstage, when he wanted to go, he wanted to go. That was it. Nothing was standing in his way. And he was always a little bit impatient and restless. He wanted to do his work and move on.
Well, why don't we hear Don't Be a Do-Badder from Robin and the Seven Hoods with Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr.
Take it from me, don't.
Sort of cute, like, you know. Watch your Frank's
give
you
the
foot.
Downbeat.
He's closest to you.
Take it from me.
Once more. Hold it. Once more. Now, you want to come in on with the bells, right?
Or should you?
Wherever you go,
should
like
you
that.
Start the ah, baby,
no,
and then
no,
all of us come
no,
in?
No, no, no.
We'll go.
We'll come in. It's 1, 2, 3.
Take it from me.
That's where it's going to be.
Okay.
And this ain't it. I'm going home.
Come on, let's go.
To New Jersey.
Take it from me. Don't be a do-batterer, do-batterer, do-batter. Just climb aboard that step ladder and climb the other way.
That's the way the note ends. I think your bells are flat.
No, it's us if it's down there.
What?
I Let's try one more. Right. This is going to be it. I never waited as much time with a soliloquy.
Let's go.
That's an outtake from Robin and the Seven Hoods with Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Sammy Davis Jr. It's featured on the new box set, Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. My guests are the box set's co-producers, Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch. Listening to this session, it strikes me maybe one of the reasons why Sinatra wants to get out so badly and end the session is because it's such a crummy song. It's so unworthy of his gifts as a singer. And particularly singing this trio, it's not really like a Sinatra recording. It's not Sinatra the singer. It's just like a novelty tune.
Well, that's the interesting thing about Frank Sinatra and his films. And I think this was another part of his philosophy. Frank Sinatra always viewed his recordings for Capitol, Reprise, Columbia as being permanent and the films as being fun. And obviously with Robin and the Seven Hoods, he's mugging for the camera. Mm-hmm. It's a fun film. It's the Rat Pack. And the music reflects that.
Charles Granata and Didier Deutsch are the producers of the box set Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. Our interview was recorded in July when the box was released. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sugar Association, educating consumers about sugar. Sugar, the natural sweetener, 15 calories per teaspoon, on the web at sugar.org. And Harcourt, publisher of Jose Saramago's The Cave, an allegory for our times. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, singer Michael Feinstein plays selections from his private collection of rare and archival recordings, featuring songwriters Harold Arlen and Harry Warren, and singers Judy Garland and Rosemary Clooney. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the first day of our Holiday Week series Encores, featuring our favorite music interviews of 2002. Michael Feinstein is one of the best-known performers of American popular song. During the last few years of Ira Gershwin's life, Feinstein was Gershwin's assistant. Feinstein couldn't have asked for a better break. At the time, he was a young performer, an ardent music fan. Through his association with Gershwin, he learned the stories behind many songs and was introduced to many songwriters. Over the years, he's put together an incredible collection of rare recordings that he found in songwriters' homes, Hollywood studio vaults, and Hollywood area flea markets. He's going to play some of those recordings for us. Now, over the years, you've gotten to know several great composers who who are still alive or were still alive when you were younger. And you have some rare home recordings that some of them have made, and you've brought a couple of those with you today. One of the things that you've brought with you is a recording that you got, you say, from Ira Gershwin's closet.
Yes.
Back when you were working with Ira Gershwin. And this is a recording of Harold Arlen singing at a party. Tell us about this recording.
Well, this is very interesting, Terry, because when I first started working for Ira Gershwin, he actually hired me to catalog his phonograph records, and he used to call me his demon discographer. And I found a number of these home recordings that were not labeled that were in Ira's closet. And these were things that had been made on a machine that he once had. And there was a whole set of recordings from a party he had around 1938 that included Harold Arlen, Yip Harburg, Milton Ager, who wrote Happy Days of Harrigan, Doc McGonigal, who wrote comedy sketches for Beatrice Lilly, Harold's wife Anya Arlen, who was a Goldwyn girl, Leonore Gershwin. And I found this one recording, which was all beat up but still playable, of a song sung by Harold, but it's a song I had never heard of, and it wasn't documented anywhere. When I saw Yip Harburg a couple months after discovering it, I said, "Yip, did you write this song?" And I sang him a couple lines. He said, no, that had to be written by Ted Kohler. Those rhymes, he said, "Oh, those awful rhymes. Don't know which way to lean, betwixt and between." He said, "That had to be Ted Kohler." He was very pejorative. Nevertheless, I think it's a delightful song.
And who's singing the Fats Waller-ish kind of backup vocal here?
Oh, you mean that sort of "Who got you?" Said that's
exactly.
That's Doc McGonigal, and then you'll hear Yip Harburg, who says, "Take that bridge back out of your mouth, boy," and Ira's the one who's saying, "What's all this talk about a wall, and then talk about a fence?" So they're all just hanging around, just having a good time, and nettling Harold, who barely manages to get through the song.
So this is Harold Arlen singing a song he wrote the music for, and he's at the piano too.
Yes.
Okay, and this is, what year is this?
1938.
Okay.
"You got me sitting on the fence. Don't know which way to lean. Oh, Doc, you got me sitting on the fence. I'm betwixt and between. Like Humpty Dumpty, I'll soon be slipping off that wall. And if I got to go before I go, I want to know. The little things you do, because you know my hands are tied. Now that I'm running after you, I hope you're satisfied. Why do you keep me in suspense? How would you like to be in love with someone and be sitting on a fence like me? You got me sitting on the fence.
Who's got you sitting on that fence?
Don't know which way to lean.
Oh, you know which way to lean, all right, you rascal.
You got me sitting on the fence.
What fence?
I'm betwixt and between.
You between the devil and the
deep blue silly position.
What's that you said?
Be slipping off the wall.
What's you talk about a wall, I talk about a fence.
Why can't I go before I go? I want to know.
That's Harold Arlen singing it at the piano. It was recorded in 1938 on a home recording. My guest is Michael Feinstein, who found this recording in Ira Gershwin's closet. Feinstein worked with Ira Gershwin for many years. And Feinstein has a new recording himself. This one is called Michael Feinstein with the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. Michael Feinstein, how did you start working with lyricist Ira Gershwin? What a terribly lucky break to have.
It was wonderful to work with Ira because I had idolized his work for so long. I met him through June Levant less than a year after I moved to Los Angeles.
This was June, Oscar Levant's wife?
Exactly. She was Oscar's widow, and I met her after I found a series of recordings that were home recordings of Oscar Levant's in a used record shop in Hollywood. I got June Levant's phone number through a lady I was working with at a piano store, and June and I became friends. I met her because of these recordings, and she was very, very sweet because she recognized something in me that was unusual for a kid of 20 years old, and that was an enthusiasm and a great knowledge of not only Oscar Levant's music, but the Gershwins and all the other contemporary songwriters of that time. And so she created an introduction to Ira. And so in July of 1977, there I was sitting in Ira Gershwin's living room, and he asked me to start working for him, taking care of his memorabilia.
What did that mean? What exactly were your responsibilities?
My first responsibility was cataloging the records in the phonograph room. Ira was in a deep depression because his closest friend, Eddie Carter, had just died. Eddie was Raymond Chandler's literary agent, and when he retired, he started working with Ira as a secretary just for fun, just to hang around with Ira. And Eddie died of cancer, and Ira was just in this funk, and his wife, Leonor, was trying to find some way to bring Ira out of it. And when they met me, Mrs. Gershwin realized that I was somebody who would probably bring new blood and new life to Ira, and she pulled me aside and said, I want you to do whatever you want in this house. She said, I'm going to open up every closet and drawer, and you can find whatever you want, create your own duties. But most of all, she said, I want you to keep Ira happy. And so I was doing this cataloging work, but I was doing it alongside Ira so I could engage him. And so if I play an old record, he'd respond to it, or I'd find a lyric sheet or find a manuscript of an unpublished Gershwin song to show to him. And it really brought him back. And it was the most extraordinary experience because I was actually being paid to spend time with this person who was one of my idols.
How old was he when you started working with him?
He was 80 years old. And he was very reclusive. He was housebound at that time, and eventually he became bedroom-bound. He got out of bed, but he never left the bedroom. And he was alert and sharp and bright and funny and very much a father or a grandfather figure to me. He was very, very sweet, very shy. He was so shy that he rarely went to parties. He absolutely retreated into this little shell, and after his brother George died in 1937 at the age of 38, he never quite recovered from that.
You obviously want to hear all of his more obscure songs and obscure home recordings. Did he want to hear that too?
He did, because he loved the memories that they brought back to him. Some of his favorite songs were not necessarily songs that were hits. For example, Love Walked In is a song that he didn't like very much. My Cousin in Milwaukee is a song that he loved, and that's a song that was hardly recorded at all.
You want to recite a little or sing a little of the lyric for that?
I've got a cousin in Milwaukee. She's got a voice so squawky, but makes your heart get kind of gawky 9 times out of 10. Now let's see the bridge. When she sings hot, you can't be solemn. Sends the shivers up and down your spinal column. When she sings blue, the men shout, what stuff? That baby is hot stuff. So the bridge, the whole idea of the bridge is that when she sings hot, the people had the reaction of hearing the blues, and when she'd sing the blues, it sounded like a hot song. So that's why she was all mixed up.
So what do you think of the song? Did you share his enthusiasm for it?
I think it's an adorable song. I like it musically. It's a bit of an antique lyrically, because it's a certain kind of song that was written for a Polish comedian named Lida Roberti, and the reason Ira used the word hot is because she was famous for saying the word hot as chat. So she'd say, I got a cousin in Milwaukee, when he sings chat, I can't. So the whole thing was putting that ch sound, so it was really written for a specific performer. But Ira loved it, so there we are.
No, when you talk to Ira Gershwin about songs, would he give you little lessons in lyric writing?
Oh, yes, yes. He not only would instruct me as to different sorts of rhymes, as to what was appropriate and what was not, but also how to interpret a song, as he did with Someone to Watch Over Me, as it nettled him that most singers would sing in the bridge of Someone to Watch Over Me, although he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome, to my heart he carries the key. And the rhyme is, he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome. And he was always teaching me to look for those inner rhymes and those little special twists that sometimes singers miss.
My guest is singer Michael Feinstein. We'll hear more recordings from his personal collection after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with singer Michael Feinstein. He's brought some rare recordings from his personal collection. I want to get to another recording that you've brought with you. This is another home recording. It's a home recording of a very obscure Ira Gershwin song, a song I think you helped rediscover, called Ask Me Again. What's the story behind this song?
Oh, well, this was one of Ira's favorite unpublished Gershwin songs. There was a cache of unknown Gershwin songs that Ira had been holding back all those years since his brother had died in 1937, and he didn't know what to do with them. They were like little diamonds, and he wanted to release them to the public, but he wanted them to be released in a way that they would get attention, that they would mean something, because he knew that if he just published them, that they would fall by the wayside. So he was always hoping to find a project to put these songs into, something that would make them important. And he never found the project that did that. So in 1983, the year of his death, I had taken this one song, Ask Me Again, which was originally written around 1930 for Girl Crazy, and asked Rosemary Clooney if she would sing it while I recorded it, because I was hoping that if I heard Rosemary sing it, then he would agree to allow us to perform it and to release it to the public. I recorded Rosemary doing it. She did a marvelous, marvelous interpretation of it just off the cuff. And Ira listened to it, and he said, "My God, it sounds like I wrote that song 50 years ago just waiting for Rosemary to sing it." And I said, "Can she sing it?" He said, "Oh, yes." And he allowed it to be introduced for the first time a couple of months after that home recording was made.
Well, let's listen to this 1983 home recording that you made with you at the piano, Rosemary Clooney singing, the recording you made to convince Ira Gershwin to let you introduce the song. Here it is.
Ask me again, who's the one I've begun to adore? Ask me again, who's the partner my heart clamors for? Where I'm at, who is it makes my friends all find that I've a one track heart and mind? Oh, ask me again, let me tell how I fell from the start. Shout to the world, it's you.
That's Rosemary Clooney with my guest Michael Feinstein at the piano, a home recording made in 1983, a song by George and Ira Gershwin, a really beautiful song. And how wonderful to hear Rosemary Clooney. You must be so sorry about losing her. I know you were very close.
She was like my second mother. She called me her sixth child, and I've been waking up every day thinking of her. I just loved her so much, and when I hear her voice, it just takes me into a special place in my heart. There was something so special. She was so gifted, and we're so lucky that she was around in our time.
Did you get to know her through Ira Gershwin? Because if I remember correctly, she was Ira Gershwin's next-door neighbor and then ended up moving into his house after he died. Do I have that right?
Close. She was Ira's next-door neighbor, yes. She actually, in 1953, with her then-husband, Jose Ferrer, bought a house that had been occupied by Ira and George in 1936 and 1937. When George Gershwin died, Ira moved out of the house that Rosemary later bought, and in 1940, he bought the house that was next door to the house he had originally occupied. So Ira bought a house in 1940 at 1021 Roxbury, And in 1953, Rosemary and Joe Ferrer bought the house at 1019 Roxbury.
And is that how you got to know her?
Yes, we actually met through kitty cats, because Rosemary had some cats, and Lee and Ira had one cat that they had actually stolen from Polly Bergen, who lived another two doors down. It's a long story, and Polly, when I mentioned that, she said, Polly said, "Yeah, that bitch, she stole my cat," referring to Leonor. But in any event, Lee was very concerned that Rosemary wasn't taking proper care of her cat, because the cat would always come to the Gershwin house to eat the shrimp that Leonor left out. Now, what cat is going to go home and eat its own food when Mrs. Gershwin is leaving shrimp? But in any event, I went next door, and it was because of their cat that I met Rosemary, and she invited me in, and I stayed for a long time.
Well, you've brought with you, one of the rare recordings you've brought with you is an outtake of Rosemary Clooney on Bob Hope's radio show, recorded in April of 1954. Well, say something about this before we hear it. Introduce it for us.
Well, 1954 was a year when magnetic tape recording had become standard usage for radio. Before 1950, everything was done live, or most things were done live. And by that period in the 1950s, everybody was recording the shows and then editing later, which I guess lost some spontaneity, but also allowed good stuff to be captured. In this instance, Bob was asking Rosemary about her husband, Jose Ferrer, and asking about the relationship. They'd only been married about a year. And Rosemary gave a response that in those days was not appropriate to use on the airwaves.
A little naughty for the time.
Quite.
Well, let's hear it. And this is Bob Hope asking Rosemary Clooney about her husband, Jose Ferrer.
Rosemary, you are one of the world's greatest exponents of lowbrow, bebop, and jazz. Joe is one of the world's finest Shakespearean actors and is considered very highbrow. How do you two get along intellectually?
Intellectually?
Yeah.
We meet somewhere around the middle. I mean, we're both kind of middle brow.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
That's mighty fine country through there. Oh, I love that.
Oh, what shears on this
show.
Oh, huh?
I love that.
The scissors. Oh.
Oh, I wish we could use that, too.
That's Rosemary Clooney, an outtake from her appearance on the Bob Hope radio show in 1954. We'll hear more recordings from Michael Feinstein's collection after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with singer Michael Feinstein. He's brought some rare recordings from his personal collection. Now, another session you've brought with you, one of your finds, is a Judy Garland outtake from Annie, Get Your Gun. She was cast in the movie before Betty Hutton got the part. Why didn't she stay with the film?
As I understand it, she was simply too ill, that she was not showing up on time on the set, and they finally had to fire her. She was devastated at that, but clearly she was in no condition to work, and she was holding up the production. The budget was going haywire because she had become so unreliable because she just wasn't well. And it's no secret that the studio was working her too hard, and they asked her to come back to work at that point much too soon, and she had begged them to take more time off before that. And she simply couldn't do it. She did record a set of soundtracks for the whole film, and she's in varying vocal shape through those sessions. On some of them she sounds terrible, and some of them she sounds better. This thing that I've brought is the unedited session where Judy keeps missing a line, and she sounds like she's in decent shape that day, but she's supposed to sing, "There's no business like show business if you tell me it's so," and she keeps singing, "Like no business I know," and she misses it once, then she laughs and she says to Roger Edens, who did the layout and her mentor, she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Roger." And finally she gets it. And from that unedited session that you're going to hear, they did splice together what was the finished vocal version.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Judy Garland, an outtake from Annie Get Your Gun, the film.
The opening, when your heart beats like a drum. The closing, when the customers won't come.
There's no business. Oh, I'm sorry.
Gee, I couldn't see it.
Larry, keep the same tempo. Keep the same tempo.
When the customers won't come.
There's no business like show business, like no business.
If you tell me.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Roger.
Yeah, it causes the music.
When the customers won't come.
There's no business like show business if you tell me it's so.
Traveling through the country is so thrilling. Standing out in front on opening night. Smiling as you watch the benches filling and see your billing up there in lights.
There's no people like show people. They smile when they are lost.
Even with the turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out in the cold.
Still you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold. Let's go on with our show. Let's go on with the show.
That was Judy Garland singing with Frank Morgan, Howard Keel, and Keenan Wynn. It's one of the rare recordings that my guest Michael Feinstein has brought with him. Michael Feinstein has a new CD in which he sings accompanied by the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. No, you know, in addition to performing, you're also a song collector, and the great thing is you put the two together by performing, in addition to popular songs, some very rare songs. And you have you've scoured flea markets and homes and basements and movie studios as well. How have you gotten access to movie studios looking for outtakes and forgotten recordings?
My initial access came because of Ira Gershwin. Ira wrote me a letter of introduction that allowed me to get into the RKO studios in the late 70s. And it was possible because of him quite frequently, because in the early days I was looking for Gershwin materials. But after I became somewhat known, a lot of studio librarians and archivists would let me in because they knew that my intentions were pure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael Feinstein, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a true pleasure.
Michael Feinstein. His latest CDs of his own singing are Michael Feinstein and the Israel Philharmonic and the Livingston and Evans Songbook. Here's Feinstein singing my favorite of all the Christmas songs with the song's co-composer, Hugh Martin, at the piano.
Christmas future is far away. Christmas past is past. Christmas present is here today, bringing joy that will last. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, troubles will be out of sight.
We'll close today's show with a 1956 recording of this song, performed by the song's composers, Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine. I'm Terry Gross. Merry Christmas from all of us at Fresh Air.
When the steeple bells sound their A,
they don't play it in tune, but the welkin will ring one day, and that day will be soon. Have yourself a merry little Christmas, let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas, make the Yuletide gay. Next year all our troubles will be miles away. Soon we all will be together, if the fates allow. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue Fresh Air Encores, our week-long series featuring favorite music interviews of 2002. We'll hear from David Bowie, Grandmaster Flash, and the biographer of the singer, Dusty Springfield. Join us for the next Fresh Air. My work's down the drain. She's a total blam-blam. She said she had to squeeze a Dutchie.